So first, I just want to check the microphone level. How are you all doing in the back? Can you hear me okay? I see lots of thumbs up. Great. Practitioners. There are these five powers. What five? The power of faith, the power of energy, the power of mindfulness, the power of concentration, and the power of wisdom. The Buddha goes on to speak about the last of these, the culmination of this list. And what is the power of wisdom? Here a noble disciple is wise. They possess the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. This is called wisdom. This is called the power of wisdom. Sariputta is one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, said to be foremost in wisdom. And there's a famous story in the teachings of Sariputta's enlightenment. He was wandering, looking for the true teachings, and he came across a man who seemed serene, who seemed awakened. He asked about this practitioner and his teacher, and the practitioner was named Asaji, one of the original five ascetics that practiced with the Buddha before his awakening. And when Sariputta asked Asaji about his teacher's teaching before Sariputta had ever met the Buddha, Asaji said this: "Whatever phenomena arise from a cause, their cause and their cessation has been told in the teaching of the Tathagata, the great contemplative." Then, to Sariputta the wanderer, as he heard this exposition of Dhamma, there arose the dustless, stainless Dhamma eye. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. Origination and cessation, arising and passing, impermanence. You all know that this is at the heart of these teachings. This phrase about the stainless Dhamma eye, when I first encountered it, it just seemed so strange to me. I thought of like stainless steel cookware. But there's, this metaphor in the teachings of having dust in one's eyes or little dust in one's eyes, having not much that might obscure one's clear seeing. All of us, having come to a retreat like this, are those with little dust in our eyes. Some days may feel dustier than others. And this metaphor is used to talk about the experience of awakening. That the eye of the Dhamma arises and sees all phenomena appearing as impermanent. So Brian talked a couple nights ago about the seven factors of awakening, And the second, after mindfulness, was Dhamma Vichaya, or investigation. And tonight, I want to talk to you about one area, one realm that you can invest with investigation. And this is the realm of the impermanent nature of each experience that we have. Before I had ever sat a long retreat, I got a little glimpse, my first glimpses into the potential for practitioners of having a wise perception into impermanence. I was a few years into the practice, and I was volunteering, teaching at a prison. It's actually, some of you who are around here may know it. It's out on Route 2, about an hour away at the Rotary. In Concord. And I remember there was a practitioner there, and he was really struggling. And he had been incarcerated for a nonviolent crime, for some just bad choices related to an opioid addiction. And his wife was on the outside and was kind of losing a fight with cancer. And he was really struggling. And at some point, in this little community that we had together, we started to talk about highlighting the perception of impermanence in one's practice. And I'll never forget, I came in one week, and he was just like a light, like on fire. And he said, "I was brushing my teeth." And I was paying attention to the changing phenomena of the sensations in my mouth. And then all of a sudden, and if you've ever given a really excited report to a teacher, you know what the rest sounds like. And he talked about how this, you know, blossoming of a different way to relate to the mundane experiences, not just mundane, but the quite brutal and difficult experiences of life in prison, just transformed his whole day. He said, "I walked out in the yard and I could hear birds." He just looked at me, he's like, "I could hear birds." You know, I mean, one thing about, you know, just spending time in this prison is, you know, I noticed eventually it's like there's not a single tree in this place, you know. And so I understood when he said I could hear birds. And he talked about how it's like on one level all the same stuff was going on. All the same difficult, painful stuff was going on in prison life. And at another level, at the same time, there's a whole different relationship to the same things that are happening. One where we feel the impermanent dance of life and phenomena. And it brought him so much authentic joy. So this is what I want to talk to you about. I remember this wasn't in my notes, but I remember my one of the other volunteers who was a great friend, her name was Sarah. She's a retired psychotherapist. She's in her late 70s and quite a wise being. And she had this phrase she loved to say after a lifetime of practice and just hard-won wisdom of living. She would say, "Happiness is the flow-through." That's what she would always do this with her hands for someone's. "Happiness is the flow-through." Yeah. And so sometimes this talking about perceiving impermanence in the Vipassana scene can at times be dark. All things are subject to passing away. But I share these stories just to open, to point toward the possibility of joy and levity, freedom of heart that comes from this practice. You So we could say in each experience that we have that there are three parts. There's arising, there's changing, and there's passing away. Every experience has these three things. If we want to encourage the wise perception of impermanence to develop, we can highlight any of these three in our meditation practice. And then when we begin to see, to feel and taste and know, the way that life shows up directly for us in immediacy, it's as if it's possible for the heart to have a freer, more easeful relationship to it. A teacher who's a guiding teacher here at IMS named Guy Armstrong says this about how we bring this perception into our meditation practice and what happens. He says, now we see how changeable reality is. Every time we feel a breath, we notice that it has a beginning and an end. Every sound we hear starts and stops. Every sensation we feel changes under our gaze. Every thought that arises also passes away. In fact, as we observe sense objects again and again, we find that not a single one lasts. Sometimes an emotion may last for hours, or in rare cases, days, but eventually it changes or fades away. Even a persistent emotion like grief or depression goes through many variations in intensity in a day's time. The body may look similar from one day to the next, but it may have gained weight, sprouted facial hair, or reacted to an insect bite. Everything is changing. He says, this truth of impermanence is a cornerstone of the Buddhist teaching. We suffer because we try to hold on to things that don't last. Now, in our practice in this tradition, often passing away, particularly of these three, arising, changing, and passing away, often passing away is emphasized. And that's especially because of how well it can demonstrate to the mind the futility of craving and clinging to what eventually is going to change and break apart and disappear. The chant that you've heard on some nights, Anicca Vata Sankara, points to this. It says, all things are impermanent, they arise and pass away. In arising, they are coming to an end. Their coming to peace is bliss. This emphasis of the passing away. Mahasi Sayadaw, I don't know if his name has brought into the retreat yet, but none of us would be here practicing in this way if it weren't for this Burmese teacher who in many ways is kind of one of the great democratizers of Vipassana meditation practice and is responsible for teaching a great many lay people in Burma about how to practice Vipassana meditation when it was beforehand mostly practiced by monks and nuns. Mahasi says, one's knowledge remains concerned exclusively with the arising and passing away of the processes noticed. For then, at each act of noticing, one sees the noticed object having arisen disappears instantly. In this way, one understands by direct experience how bodily and mental processes arise and break up from moment to moment. Now, I'll mention that while can be quite skillful to highlight the passing away, I find that in my own practices at certain times it's very helpful to highlight the arising. It gives a little bit of a different flavor to experience. I find that it can help with sleepiness, you know, to notice moment after moment, new things are arising. Even at times in my practice, you know, if the mind is really steady, noticing arisings, highlighting that particular element of our changing experience can bring a lot of delight, even wonder. Just that life can feel like a single file line of gifts in some way. You know, new experience every moment. But it's not always easy to perceive experience wisely. There's a teaching of the Buddha's that I think we'll talk about more later on in the retreat about the distortions of mind, how we misperceive our experience. And the very top of the list, the first of the distortions that the Buddha notes is sensing permanence in the changing. He says, though, that for practitioners, it is possible to recuperate their right mind and to see change in what is changing. And that when they do, they overcome all suffering. That's not a small payoff, you know, for adjusting this little distortion of mind. So I want to highlight tonight, I wanted to pull out and highlight two particular areas where in my own experience I've noticed that it's a little bit difficult. You know, it's less natural to perceive that which is impermanent as impermanent, where the mind gets caught in staying on a surface level where our experience feels like it's made up of somewhat permanent experiences or objects. So the two that I'll highlight are in two areas of what we call the six sense spheres, which we've talked about a bit. The five senses of the body: touch, sight, sound, taste, smell, and the thinking, feeling mind. And of the six, for me, I notice that particularly seeing and thinking are areas where the mind gets duped into this distortion of seeing permanence in what is impermanent. So most of the time when we see, the mind sees objects. Whatever we recognize, it's like the mind makes it a thing. We often miss that it is changing and impermanent. In my field of vision, for instance, this thing looks pretty solid and permanent. You know, if I thought about it for a while, well, yes, someone put it together and eventually it'll come apart. But in terms of my moment-to-moment perception of my experience of the world, when I'm seeing, I see a thing. And the thing seems pretty solid and sturdy. Yeah. And it's true. It's a good thing I can rely on this thing to hold my talk, you know. It's scary enough to get up in front of a room full of silent yogis and give a talk. I don't need the podium disintegrating on me, right? But mindfulness sees the seeing process. The habitual mind sees things. Mindfulness sees the seeing process. So if we're on retreat and we want to rest in a perception of impermanence throughout the day, we need to see if it's possible to notice the seeing process instead of making objects out of everything that appears. You know, can you see the seeing? In my experience, we call these sense doors. And with seeing and the eyes, it's like I walk right out the door. Right? It's a doorway, and it's like I walk out the door and I'm gone. Home is far behind, right? You know, I look out and I see the Kuan Yin in the back. I see the fan. I see all of you. It's as if awareness is just out there.
Yes.
But it's possible to come back. It feels to me like staying. Actually, I think I have this image in this moment of my mother's, how she has a beautiful garden on the front porch, and there's stairs leading down, so it's kind of a little terrace and all these things growing. And it's like, you know, on a warm day, opening the door and standing there at the doorway, recognizing what's out there, but not feeling lost, chasing what's going by.
Yes.
So I just thought of this other example. I don't know if you've ever had the experience where you've been to the movies, you're watching the movie, and you're totally engrossed. You're like inside the screen, living in the movie. And then all of a sudden in the theater, you recognize, oh yes, I'm in a movie theater. You see what's around the screen. The screen becomes a screen for a moment. You maybe see the curtains on either side. You see the row of chairs. And all of a sudden, you can still pay attention to the movie. You're not missing the plot. You see all the action. You hear all the sounds, right? You know what's going on. It's all being taken in. And yet, there's an awareness, actually, of the perimeter. And I find this is actually a really helpful exercise. There are several different mindfulness of seeing exercises that you can try, and I'll give you one to explore right now. Okay? So what it is it's taking this same experience of seeing a movie screen and noticing the perimeter. Right now, see if you can notice the perimeter of what you see. Probably you've been looking at me as a thing up here. You're in the movie. Step back for a moment. One of the things that I like to do that you can try is if you look up so that you're not looking at anybody else, you know, in the room, you can just take your hands and put them on either side of your eyes so they'll be kind of like the curtains of the movie screen. And you can just rest back in mindfulness and very gently let the eyes move from side to side, let the head tilt. And see if you can see it like a movie screen. The hands are still and steady, but what's on the screen is moving. Can you feel like you're standing at the doorway of the sense door rather than going out and getting lost in what seems to be out there? To see the seeing process. Now that little exercise may have felt like it worked for some of you or not feel like it worked for others of you. That's not a big deal. Okay. It's just to begin to play with, can you recognize that it's not just things in front of you. There's a whole process of seeing that can be known moment to moment. When you start to notice it in this way, the moment you close your eyes for a second, seeing passes away. All of a sudden you open and seeing arises. Yes. When we experience it like this, it is a dynamic, changing phenomenon. And we're less caught in the world of concepts about what we see. The concepts is the next thing I want to talk about, the other sense door that can be quite troublesome in my practice for perceiving wisely the impermanent as impermanent. So I'll share two things that I have read about, learned about, that come from some contemporary thinking in evolutionary psychology that have really struck me as a contemplative practitioner as interesting and relevant for what it's like to bring this mind into this practice. The first is this idea that as human beings evolved, What allowed us to compete and survive was the development of language. As we developed words, they could create concepts, representative concepts of what we experience. Not our direct experience, but the idea of what we experience. And that having those concepts allowed us to tell stories to one another, which helped us cooperate in larger groups and cooperate with more nuance and in greater numbers. And so as that allowed our species to survive, that faculty developed more and more and more strongly. And now we're master storytellers, not just to each other, but all day long. There is always a story. And maybe, I don't know, but it sounds like some people think that it may be that we are wired this way to constantly tell stories because those of us who were doing that exceptionally well survived. Yes. The other idea that really struck me as relevant here is that as evolving organisms, we got rewarded with survival and a nice cocktail of neurotransmitters like dopamine every time that we solved a problem. It's like, if there's a problem and you solve it, it's like, whew, you get to survive another day and the brain's like, good job. Have a brain cookie. And having an organism that rewards that problem solving over the millennia evolved beings that start looking for an opportunity to get a brain cookie. Where are the problems at? Because when I solve them, that's real nice. And so all of a sudden, we develop minds that start looking and seeing the world in terms of problems to be solved. And if there aren't any, we make them up. Ooh, just take that dagger out. You know. So much of the time we're used to navigating the world using these approaches to understand what's happening. And so in order to take care of ourselves, we turn away from our direct experience and turn instead toward the thinking mind. Something goes wrong, we go to the thinking mind. Say, tell me the story of what's happening and how I get out of it. What are the problems here and how do I solve them? Yes. We ask the thinking mind to explain what's happening in terms of a story and the problems. Great Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh says this about trying to understand our experience through the thinking mind. He says, understanding does not arise as a result of thinking. It is a result of the long process of conscious awareness. Sometimes understanding can be translated into thoughts, but often thoughts are too rigid and limited to carry much understanding. Sometimes a look or a laugh expresses understanding much better than words or thoughts. So in this practice, we look less and less to the habit of meaning-making and narrative-making, to our thoughts, concepts, and we touch a raw intimacy with life, where life is no longer being interpreted by the thinking mind. Life can speak for itself. As I was writing this talk, it just came to me. It's like if we extend this metaphor, it's as if mindfulness is learning to speak the native language of our direct experience. Yeah. And when we learn this language, it's like we can stop going to the mind as an interpreter. We're free to live and dance and eat with the locals, you know, seeing, hearing, feeling, and all the rest, right? As we become skilled at this, we see that the interpreter still hangs around, right? Still tags along, explaining the music. But over time, we learn to stop listening because we're too busy dancing. Yeah. I think I have time for both these examples that I want to share. So before we close, we have some time here. I want to share two examples of two different teachers highlighting how it can look in our practice to highlight the perception of impermanence and the results that can come from this. And one example is one of how this investigation, this perception, can support our practice on a more classic Vipassana style development, yeah. Insight, developing insight into experience. And the other is how this perception, this investigation can support a deepening of samadhi, collectedness of mind, steadiness, tranquility. These are often talked about two pathways of meditation. And some of you may find that at this time in the retreat, you're a little more inclined towards investigation and insight into your experience. And some of you may find you're a little more inclined towards studying, deepening, becoming more tranquil. So I wanted to bring in two examples of using this wise perception to support the deepening of either kind of style of practice. Yeah. So the first is to tell you a story that comes from the suttas. I won't lie and I'll tell you, I'll admit actually that I project onto this like a little bit of a love story. The romance element is just all in my own mind, but I can't help it because the story is just so good. So I pulled from different resources. I'm going to share with you a small piece of the sutta itself, but I'm also going to share with you the backstory, which comes from the commentaries. This story is about a woman who was regarded as the foremost among all of the nuns at the time the Buddha was living in teaching the Dhamma. Her name was Dhammadina. That can translate as one who has given herself to the Dhamma. And this is really interesting because it's one of the few suttas that's not actually the Buddha's teaching. It's the teaching of one of his disciples. And this teaching comes from her. So this is an example of how insight into impermanence can really yield insight in the Vipassana practice. So Vishakha was a merchant and lay Buddhist disciple, and Dhammadina was his wife. As a lay follower, once while hearing the Buddha teach the unsurpassed Dhamma, Vishakha awoke to the third stage of enlightenment. And from this moment, neither greed nor hatred held any influence over his mind. Dhammadina and Vishakha shared their love of the Dhamma with each other. And when she asked to leave him to ordain and become part of the order of nuns under Mahapajapati, Vishakha couldn't refuse. On taking up the monastic precepts and through her diligence following the Buddha's instructions for the development of mindfulness, wisdom, and compassion, and because of all the merit she had developed in this life and stretching back across many lives, when the conditions were right, the nun Dhammadina attained not just to the third stage of awakening, but full liberation of the heart and mind, surpassing her former husband, who had introduced her to the teachings, and realizing the fruition of her own path. Some time later, on hearing of her development on the path, Vishakha came to see Dhammadina to reunite and ask questions about the Dhamma. This sutta describes the conversation between two awakened beings who had once shared a life together as householders. The sutta is long, and I'm just going to highlight a small part of the teaching on bringing the wise perception of impermanence to mindfulness of vedana, or feeling, which Greg spoke about. It's short, but it shows the profound potential implications for wisdom and non-clinging that can develop when anybody brings this perception into their practice. This is the Chula Vidala Sutta, a shorter set of questions and answers. I have heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's sanctuary. Then Vishakha, the lay follower, went to Dhammadina, the nun, and on arrival, having bowed down to her, sat to one side. Noble lady, how many kinds of feeling are there? Sir Vishakha, there are three kinds of feeling: pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, and neutral feeling. Noble lady, what is pleasant feeling? What is unpleasant feeling? What is neutral feeling? Sir Vishakha, anything physical or mental that is felt as pleasant and agreeable is pleasant feeling. Anything physical or mental that is felt as unpleasant and disagreeable is unpleasant feeling. Anything physical or mental that is felt as neither agreeable nor disagreeable is neutral feeling. Noble lady, in regard to pleasant feeling, what is pleasant and what is unpleasant? In regard to unpleasant feeling, what is pleasant and what is unpleasant? In regard to neutral feeling, what is pleasant and what is unpleasant? She says, Sir Vishakha, a pleasant feeling is pleasant while it remains, and unpleasant upon changing. An unpleasant feeling is unpleasant while it remains, and pleasant upon changing. A neutral feeling is pleasant when there is knowledge, and unpleasant when there is ignorance. Seeing something like this directly has huge implications for our happiness. Most of our lives, our choices, our actions, how we judge how things are going, and how we feel about our circumstances is primarily governed by habitual relationships to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. If we really see for ourselves that every pleasant feeling is experienced as both pleasant and unpleasant during its life cycle, the same thing for unpleasant feelings, and that the more wisdom we develop, the more we'll experience neutral things not as boring, but as pleasant, this can change our inner relationship with the world. This is an example of how paying close attention to our experience as things change can yield really profoundly transformative insight. So many of you know that impermanence is talked about in Buddhism as being one of the three universal characteristics of all conditioned phenomena. And so the other two that it's often talked about right alongside are the truth of stress, sometimes talked about as, what's my favorite one? Dissatisfactoriness, that any given phenomena can't provide lasting satisfaction, and also corelessness, as a term that Greg used earlier in the retreat, or non-self often. Its impermanence is often talked about as one of these three characteristics of all phenomena. So I want to share with you how one teacher describes how developing a wise perception of impermanence, or any of these three characteristics, can support the deepening of samadhi. The last teacher was one from the time of the Buddha, and this teacher is a contemporary of ours. His name is Thanissaro Bhikkhu. He is an American monastic who was ordained in the Thai forest tradition and a widely respected Pali scholar and translator. So I'll read something from him here. He says, "The strange thing, though, is that when you look in the Pali canon for the word three characteristics, that's tilakana, it doesn't appear. If you do a search on any computerized version of the canon and type in, say, the characteristic of inconstancy," he uses inconstancy for impermanence. He says it comes up with nothing. This is not to say that the concepts of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, these three characteristics, don't occur in the canon, just that they're not termed characteristics. The words that they're compounded with are perception, sanya, as in the perception of inconstancy, the perception of stress, the perception of non-self. And the word anupassana, which means to contemplate or keep track of something as it occurs. For instance, anicca-nupassana, to contemplate inconstancy. This means to look for impermanence wherever it happens. So what he's highlighting here for me, it seems quite profound, actually. The things that we talk about in Buddhist circles as characteristics of conditioned experience, they can become a kind of concept when we think of them that way, a big idea to ponder, you know, some universal characteristic, right? It's a lofty idea. But when we think about these as perceptions, we start to understand them as skillful ways to experience our life as it's happening. It's like they become a verb. When we recognize and perceive the way each thing that our attention lands on is changing, it's like putting on wisdom glasses. It changes the way that we see the world. So he goes on and he talks about how this wise perception of impermanence and the other characteristics support our deepening stages of developing samadhi, or gathering of mind. He says at the early stages, the issues of inconstancy, stress, and non-self apply primarily to the things that would distract you from your concentration. You'll use these three perceptions to analyze, say, an object of lust, anger, jealousy, or fear that would pull you out of concentration. These perceptions are relevant because they're ways of reminding yourself that you can't find true happiness in those objects or by dwelling on them. For the meantime, that's how you use these three contemplations in the early part of a deepening and gathering of mind. He says you can also apply these three contemplations to the first stages of concentration when you want to go deeper, to deeper stages. When the mind is settled and quiet on a beginning level, is it as quiet as it could be? Or is there still some inconstancy there, he says. What he's pointing to is that the process that we go through, that the Buddha describes as the mind gets more settled over time. There's a process of slow but steady deepening stabilization. And our attention goes from, which comes from recognizing the qualities of the meditating mind that are changing in more coarse, gross, more agitating ways, starts to let them fade into the background as more tranquilizing, steady qualities of mind come forward. So this could be letting little thoughts about redirecting our attention fade and just simply resting in the joy of being aware. Or it could be actually letting the joy and delight fade and allowing a more quiet and satisfying feeling of well-being and simple happiness come forward. So this is about using this perception of impermanence to recognize what's more grossly or ostentatiously changing in our experience, allowing it to fade into the background. He goes on to describe how if the samadhi becomes very deep, we can use wise perception of impermanence, or any of the three, to liberate us from any craving or attachment that we develop to these beautiful states of gatheredness of mind. He says, ultimately, as your attachments to things outside of the concentration drop away, you turn your attention more to applying these three perceptions to contemplating the concentration itself. So remember, we're not here to arrive at the true nature of things in and of themselves, aside from simply seeing how their behavior makes them inadequate as sources for true happiness. Yes. It's not a lofty idea, impermanence. It's a way to relate to the experience we're having in the moment, to perceive it as changing, arising, changing, and passing. So in all this, I want to come back to the simplicity of what this really looks like. Every experience, every phenomena that we're aware of has three parts: arising, changing, passing away. Sometimes they may be happening so quickly that you don't or can't recognize all three. That's fine. If you want to explore this wise perception of impermanence, you can simply notice which of those three is most obvious. And you can notice it at whatever the mind is perceiving right now. It doesn't matter what the mind is paying attention to. Everything is just as impermanent. That is liberating in and of itself. If we use this quality of investigation, of interest in impermanence, it doesn't matter what our attention is pointing to. We're developing wisdom. Yes. My friend Sarah is just popping back into my mind right now. Happiness is the flow through. Yes. So it doesn't have to be an arduous task to try and see the impermanent nature of things. Maybe you can just use that phrase There's a question. It's like, can I feel the flow through? There's happiness there somewhere. Yeah. If all you do is start channeling Sarah, I'll be very pleased with this talk. So I'll leave you with two things. In his book, which it examines deeply the Buddha's words on mindfulness in the Satipatthana Sutta, Bhikkhu Anālayo, who is a gift, many of our teacher, and a gift to the Dhamma world in his translation of teachings and study of comparative translations. In his book examining the sutta on mindfulness, he needs to come to a conclusion towards the end, and he's ready to sum up all of the vast teachings that are included in the Buddha's words on mindfulness. And he lands on a simple phrase that sums up all these teachings. And the phrase is, keep calmly knowing change. That's what he suggests. Keep calmly knowing change. So let's sit together quietly for a moment. In all things, including these investigations, we need to balance our energy, our effort, just as Susie spoke about last night. She used a metaphor of paddling a vessel over the water. And it reminded me of the awakening poem, the verse from the nun, Dhammadina, whose wisdom you heard earlier. So I'll read you the interpreter Maddie Weingast's rendition of her awakening poem. Dhammadina says, "For so long I thought only of the river's end. Then one morning, I set my paddle down to watch the sunrise over the eastern hills, only to find myself floating somehow, gently upstream. I promise, it was not what I had expected."